need me.
Rabia Siddique was born in India to an Indian Muslim father and white Australian mother, and they moved to Perth when she was five. Growing up in Australia, Rabia experienced discrimination and sexual abuse. But despite all that, she went on to become an international lawyer, a war crimes and terrorism prosecutor, an officer in the British Army, an author, a mother of triplets, and a marathon runner. And as amazing and exhausting as all that sounds, it still doesn't capture the full drama of what's happened in Rabia Siddique's life, including in the year that she's chosen for the year that made me. Rabia Siddique, welcome.
Lovely to be with you. Thank you, Julian.
It's great to have you. We mentioned that you were an officer in the British Army, and it was in that context, in 2005 in Iraq, that you were taken hostage, an absolutely terrifying ordeal that led to a long fight for personal justice. How did you come to be in Iraq in the British Army in the first place?
Yeah, that's a good question, particularly to ask of an Australian, I guess.
Yes.
I was always motivated by service, and I knew that I always wanted to serve others and try and help people that didn't have a voice and weren't able to access justice. So initially in Australia, I qualified and worked as a human rights and criminal lawyer for a number of years, but there was a loud voice inside my head that I finally realised was my calling, which motivated me to leave Australia in the late 1990s, and I headed for the UK. And after a number of years of volunteering for human rights agencies and working and studying in the UK, I decided that I needed to find another vehicle that would help me reach the front line and the people that so desperately needed help, people that were suffering from the most abhorrent human rights abuses, but people that lived in parts of the world and in war zones where they just simply weren't getting the help and where, I guess you could say, justice and equality were foreign to them. Mm. And so the vehicle that I decided that I would try and use and pursue was the military. I had done some research and realised that as an officer in the military, and at the time the British Army was looking for Commonwealth officers from other Commonwealth nations to sort of help strengthen their forces. And I realised that as a lawyer in the military, I could reach those people that I so desperately wanted to help. That was the reason, the motivator behind applying for and getting eventually accepted to commission as a legal officer in the British Army. And so they say timing is everything, don't they? And the week that I commissioned as a captain turned out to be the week of 9/11, which of course changed everything in the world. Yes. and changed everything for me. And within a few years of joining the Army, I was deployed as a legal officer to support the British contingent in Iraq on what we called back then Operation Telic. And I would be the first woman to carry out that role as an Allied Forces legal officer, which was quite significant at the time. I guess I was quite fortunate. Sorry. You know, you mentioned my background. I come from a Muslim family, and at the time I spoke a little bit of Arabic. So I think because of my background, because I spoke a little bit of Arabic, and because I really had been someone, thanks to my upbringing and some of the tougher experiences that I had when I was younger, I had committed very strongly to my values and to treating people with respect. And I think probably all of that served me well in building respectful and trusting relationships with my Iraqi colleagues, whom I was also sent to help.
Well, all that sounds dramatic enough, but things became even more dramatic on the 19th of September 2005. Can you tell us what happened then?
Sure. So that morning I had arrived at my base at Basra Airport in the south of the country to hear news that two of my colleagues, two British Special Forces soldiers, had been illegally kidnapped and beaten and detained. And we heard that they had been taken to a very famous place in Basra City called Al Jamiat. It was officially the largest headquarters of the Iraqi police service, but unofficially it was also the headquarters of an Iranian-backed terrorist group called the Jaish al-Mahdi, who at that stage had completely infiltrated the Iraqi police service. So you had a situation in the country where it was being governed and policed by terrorist police officers, if you can imagine how terrifying that was for the people. I knew something additional about this place, Al Jamiat, because by this stage, the situation in Iraq had become so volatile and the International Red Cross had been forced to pull out. So we knew that it was really, really serious and bad news that our two lads had been taken there.
What led to you being involved in the negotiations? Because that doesn't sound like part of your already difficult job description.
No, exactly right. And it's a very good question, because ordinarily I shouldn't have been involved in this situation. So a colleague of mine who was the same rank as me, by now I've been promoted to the rank of major, my colleague James, who was trained for this sort of scenario and had a background in intelligence and surveillance, he was ordered in by our brigadier, our commander, to take a group of his men and to see if somehow he could free or secure the release of our two guys. And within about an hour, James wasn't having any luck, and he sent us a message back saying that the Iraqi representative that had been sent in there, an Iraqi judge, made it clear that he had no interest in speaking or negotiating with James, and that the only one that he would speak to was the only one that he trusted. And he asked for me. And so on the strength of that, our commander ordered me to go in and to take over from my colleague James and to lead what we now understood to be hostage negotiations. And wow, you can imagine when I got that order, I was absolutely shaking in my boots. I was petrified because I wasn't a trained hostage negotiator. As you said, this was not indeed my area. I was the army lawyer.
And Rabia, had the judge asked for you because of that work you'd been doing, sort of engaging with the local community and the trust that you'd built?
Yes, I believe so. I mean, he did say to James, there's only one of you that I trust. There's only one of you that has shown us any respect, and that's the only person that I will speak to. So he made it clear what the reasons for why he'd called for me.
Well, it's a hell of an order to have to follow, but you did follow it. What happened, Rabia?
I was petrified, but my dad, who's a wise man, used to say to my younger brother and I that, you know, sometimes we're called upon to do tough things and uncomfortable things for the greater good. And I realised in that moment that that sort of was the type of thing that Dad was talking about. So I took a deep breath and I realised that there was no other choice. The lives of my two colleagues rested on my shoulders. So I flew in via a helicopter to the Al Jamiat compound. And initially I was doing well. The judge and I were negotiating successfully. I was able to be taken to the cell where our guys were being held to see that they were still alive. We agreed a set of actions that I would take, that I was writing down busily on what became a release contract. And just as the judge and I were about to sign this contract, the next step being that he would have released our two colleagues into my custody, everything suddenly deteriorated and all hell broke loose outside.
Why did that happen?
What had happened was, by the time I arrived, there was about 200 to 300 civilians that had surrounded the compound, because they had been told by the terrorist police officers that Israeli spies were being held inside. So they were screaming for blood and they were firing their rifles up into the air at the time that I had arrived. And about 100 British soldiers, my colleagues, had been quickly sent to try and keep them calm. What I didn't realise is the crowd outside had grown to almost 2,500, and they were now storming the compound, having set fire to my colleagues outside. Mm. We could hear explosions in the little window in the cell. We could see flames. And what I didn't realise until much later was that that was the flames of my colleagues and friends on fire. Oh, so the crowd stormed the compound, and within a matter of seconds, it was clear that we now had become hostages as well.
How did you get out, Rabia?
Took a while, about 8.5 hours until we were rescued. And during that time, being the only woman, being the only one with Muslim background and being the only Arabic speaker, all of which had served me well up until that point in my tour, now at the hands of our terrorist captors, I became the prime target. And in front of my male colleagues for 8.5 hours, I was humiliated, I was degraded, I was tortured, I was treated very, very badly. But miraculously, as I said, at the 8.5 hour point, we were all rescued in a combined British and American rescue operation. So, I mean, it was a miracle that we all survived.
Absolutely.
And that should have been the end of it. But it wasn't.
Indeed. I mean, that in itself, obviously, an incredibly traumatic event to go through, but really was a case of things getting worse in some ways, because the work that you'd done on that day wasn't recognised by the UK military, and that led to a whole new fight, one that you were at least admirably qualified for from your legal training. But can you tell us how your role in this amazing incident was treated by the authorities?
So on our return from being rescued, for the next number of days and weeks and months and even years, all my male colleagues, of which there was 5 plus the 2 original Special Forces guys, so there was 7 of them plus me that were held. all of them received a hero's welcome. They received recognition and acknowledgement of their bravery and their role in the incident. And James, my colleague, you'll recall he was the one sent in before me and then asked for me to take over. He was awarded a military cross by the Queen. And importantly, they were all provided with trauma counselling, or as we call it in the military, debriefing. So all of them received support, recognition, acknowledgement and praise. I received a written order ordering me to never speak of the role that I had performed or what I had been through. It was probably the most blatant form of institutional discrimination or sexism that you could imagine. And I didn't quite believe it for a while, and then it became clear what was happening. And I knew that I couldn't stay silent, not just for me, but for all those that had been going through and had gone through something similar. And I knew that, as you said, I was privileged, that I was in a position where I could speak out and that I could hold this institution to account. So for the next 2 years, I tried to do that and I exhausted every informal avenue I could. And as happens with institutions, they closed ranks and shut me out until the only avenue left for me to, I guess, address this very personal injustice was to mount a discrimination case and to sue the British government and the armed forces. And I did. And after 18 months, my case eventually got to court and I was successful.
Ruby, you had to mount this legal battle. Looking back on it, how do you think that affected the necessity of dealing with the original trauma of the hostage crisis and everything that you'd gone through there? And what did the way you were treated by the military do to your capacity to deal with that trauma?
That's a really interesting question. Eventually, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, which is probably not surprising. But what was really interesting is the basis of my diagnosis was not the trauma that I had experienced whilst a hostage. I had dealt with that. I had got help for that eventually of my own accord, and I had healed from that. The basis of my diagnosis was the feeling of abandonment and betrayal that I felt by those who were my colleagues, my superiors, and had a duty of care to support me and protect me. And I guess it was that feeling of desperation and sheer abandonment that broke me eventually. I did a lot of work to heal so that I could continue with the fight, but it taught me a lot about the importance of the truth, the importance of holding people in power to account. And I guess for me, the win wasn't in the win in terms of being successful in the court case. The win was in the lessons from the journey, which was that within months of my case being held, many similar cases then came through the courts. It provided a bit of an opening of the floodgates. The first woman was awarded a military cross 6 months after my case, which completely changed the whole dialogue around the role of women as first responders and on the front line. And within 12 months, there was an independent investigation into the armed forces, which led to fundamental changes in policy, legislation, and most importantly, the culture around the way women, ethnic minorities, homosexuals were treated in the armed forces. And I guess the real win and what it taught me is the power of one, the power that we all have to impact change if we choose to do so.
And Rabia, in terms of the legal case, how exactly was that resolved? And I suppose having identified that it was the mistreatment by the military that was part of the trauma and a key part of the trauma, how did the resolution of the legal case sort of work for you personally in terms of those mental health battles you've had?
Well, I never was seeking a medal and I wasn't seeking monetary gain. What I was seeking was a public apology and a public recognition and acknowledgement of the truth and the role that I had been ordered to play and what I had endured. And what I was also seeking was change, that there would be a very public undertaking, that lessons would be learnt, that there would be an independent investigation, and that this would lead to fundamental changes so no one would have to go through what I had gone through ever again. And that's what I was able to secure, which was the most important thing to me.
You got the apology as well?
I did.
Yes, yeah, well, it's a absolutely extraordinary story. And we didn't even get to what it's like to become the mother of triplets as well.
What? The staring down terrorists was all training ground for raising triplets, I can tell you. You know what? They were my three little miracle boys, and they made, I guess they were my reward for everything that I had endured beforehand.
That's just absolutely astounding. Rabia, there have been so many twists and turns in your career. What are you doing these days?
Well, I am still practicing law. I'm advising on key human rights and international cases, maybe one or two big cases a year. But I formed my own business not long after my memoir, Equal Justice, was published in 2013. And so now I focus on leadership. I work around the world. I'm very privileged to work with some amazing organizations and people across a number of sectors. And I speak about and I work with leaders and with our future leaders about how we can become better values-based leaders and bring humanity to our lives and our work, and helping people build resilience and really embrace the importance of inclusion and diversity when we're making key decisions.
Well, resilience sounds like a profound understatement in your case, Rabia. It's been amazing speaking about your life and career. Thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me. We always finish up by asking our guests to pick a song that somehow relates to The Year That Made Me. Which one have you chosen for us?
Thank you so much, Julian. Well, there's a little bit of a story to this song. In 2005, spent most of the year in Iraq, there were times, particularly when, I guess, the bombs were raining down around us, that I would get very homesick and I would think about Australia. And I would listen to a number of Aussie bands to take me back there so I could close my eyes and visualize being back at home on the beach, and Crowded House was one of them. And this particular song was one that I used to play again and again and again because some of the words just were so apt. So my song of choice is Crowded House, Better Be Home Soon.
Oh, it's a beautiful song, but I can imagine those lyrics only the more resonant when you're in Iraq working
absolutely,
in the roles that absolutely. You were working
absolutely, and thrilled
on.
To hear that they've reformed again.
And they're back, yeah, absolutely, yes, yeah. So, well, let's hear it then. Rabia Sadiq, thank you once again, and here it is, Crowded House, It Better Be Home Soon.
Somewhere deep inside, something's got a hold on you, and it's pushing me aside. See it stretch on forever, and I know I'm right. For the first time in my life, that's why I tell you, better be home soon.